Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, April 19th, 2021. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people and using some of the most powerful tools I've ever encountered to manage my emotions, improve my relationships, and generally improve the quality of my life. These tools are available absolutely free at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the red and white bullseye or the link in the upper left-hand corner of most pages that says Start Here, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book provides a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And you can print it off from a PDF on that same page and copy it and use it as often as you'd like, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness, and get access to a completely free and private app that contains that worksheet process, an abbreviated version of that process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And you can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one where people have called in and been stepped through that process. And you can use that as a series of tutorials that will help you master this simple but powerful tool. And if you choose to put it to use in your life, it probably will improve your quality of life beyond what words can describe, as it has for so many of us. And we hope people do that soon and often, because then you can give us a call and tell us how wonderfully it's working for you, or call with questions or answers or even recommendations for worksheets you would like to help us step you through live in the moment. Our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And in our current format, we're here 2 days, 2 hours a day, 5 days a week. And in our current year, we are working through the Course in Miracles lessons from the workbook. And today is the 109th day of the year. And the lesson from Saturday read, Truth will correct all errors in my mind. And what can correct illusions but truth? Well, truth will. And yesterday's lesson was, to give and to receive are the same. They're one thing in truth. And this ties into the lesson we were working in before, where it says, you know, the more we give of this energy of creation that we're made of, the more we give lovingly to others, the more we receive it. It's not a zero-sum game. Today's lesson is, I rest in God. And it says, the commentary reads, we ask for rest today and quietness, unshaken by the world's appearances. We ask for peace and stillness in the midst of all the turmoil born of clashing dreams. We ask for safety and for happiness, although we seem to look on danger and sorrow. And we have the thought that will answer our asking with what we request. I rest in God. This thought will bring to you the rest and quiet, peace and stillness, and the safety and the happiness you seek. I rest in God. This thought has the power to wake the sleeping truth in you, the truth whose vision sees beyond appearances to that same truth in everyone and everything there is. Here is the end of suffering for all the world and everyone who ever came and yet will come to linger for a while. Here is the thought in which the Son of Creation is born again to recognize himself. I rest in God, completely undismayed. This thought will carry you through storms and strife, past misery and pain, past loss and death, and onward to the certainty of God. There is no suffering it cannot heal. There is no problem that it cannot solve, and no appearance but will turn to truth before the eyes of you who rest in your Creator. This is the day of peace. You rest in creation, and while the world is torn by winds of hate, your rest remains completely undisturbed. So, we are asked to rest with the peace of creation today, quiet and unafraid. Each brother comes to take his rest and offer it to you. We rest together here, for thus our rest is made complete. And what we give today, we have received already. Time is not the guardian of what we give today. We give to those unborn and those passed by, to every thought of creation, and to the mind in which these thoughts were born and where they rest. And we remind them of their resting place each time we tell ourselves, I rest in love. I rest in creation. I rest in the Creator. I rest in God. And we've also agreed to look at Pam Grout's book, The Course in Miracles Experiment, and her chapter 109 is titled, I Can Do All Things. She quotes Glenda Green as saying, what we think is so is only a reflection of our deepest fear holding us to the shackles of limiting belief. Pam writes, Stephen Curry is one of the greatest shooters in NBA history. He has played on four all NBA teams and was voted MVP twice and recently signed the first $200 million contract in the NBA. The fact that the celebrity point guard is a dwarfish 6 feet 3 inches, tiny compared to his fellow teammates, makes it even more remarkable that among his fortes is excelling during the clutch. You see, Steph has an edge, a secret sauce. While available to all of us, few of us ever use. He employs lesson 109, I rest in God, getting his mojo from a higher source. He doesn't depend on his own strength, his own skills, his own training. Rather, he invokes the power of love, what I often call Radiant X. Every time he takes a shot, or really does anything that matters, he invokes his mantra, I can do all things. This mantra that he put on T-shirts to his favorite Bible verse, Philippians 4:13. His, quote, Curry 1, close quotes, basketball shoes even come with a lace loop scripted 4:13. While I'm not a big verse reciter, I got to admit, I can do all things through that which strengthen me is worth adding to my brain's portfolio. Today I rest in love. I can do all things through that which strengtheneth me. So that's our Course in Miracles lesson and our commentary, and our time for today remains at 49 minutes. And we have time for lots of questions, comments, discussion, or something else. How can we support you today? I'm thinking perhaps maybe the Laura McGowan interview today. So I will start this and be around. Laura McGowan, author of We Are the Luckiest, The Surprising Magic of a Sober Life. What follows is an interview I did in February of 2021 with the author Laura McGowan. Her book is titled We Are the Luckiest, The Surprising Magic of a Sober Life. I'm looking at the lauramcgowan.com and the book.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the fact that Glennon Doyle is your top endorser, that's, I'm nervous. Well, she's just.
Yeah, she's good.
Well, your book and her book are two books that I have recommended to people.
Oh, that's
a
awesome.
Lot because of the honesty piece.
Yeah, you mean Untamed, her recent
her book Untamed, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
yeah, she's we've known each other because of the online world, but like years and years ago, but really because of sobriety, because that's the, you know, one of the things we have in common. And she's been very kind and supportive of my work. Really,
well, and I tell people that, you know, as a psychologist with 46 years experience doing therapy, when I refer a book to them and the person is a surprising sober life, what do you mean? I'm not a drunkard. Well,
right.
The reason these two books, both yours and the Untamed book, gets, you know, a high recommendation from me is because each of you have found in your own ways and write very eloquently about the need for a deep, profound honesty. So we shouldn't keep talking about that.
We should
start the interview. I wanted to give you a little bit of that because I want you to know that my focus with your book is not 12 steps and an adjunct to the 12 steps. It's about anybody. As a matter of fact, I have somebody that I know, and I said, hey, you know, you're an intelligent, high-functioning woman. I'm going to be interviewing Laura. What, do you have any questions? And she wrote back this, you know, lovely, I'm stumped, I'm shocked, I feel like I'm letting you down, they don't have this great question, you know, the whole imposter kind of thing.
Yeah.
But then in the middle of it, she wrote what, for me, is the key, which is why I recommend this book to people. And she said, I realize I may be still so awestruck about Laura by hearing how similar her addiction sounds to some of the challenges I'm facing.
Yeah.
That's still rather unbelievable to me.
Mm-hmm.
It's that, you know, it's like you talk about in the book. It's doesn't matter what my thing is.
Mm-mm.
All right. If I'm avoiding my thing, or if I'm using my thing to avoid the pain I need to face,
right.
I'm in the same boat, right?
That's
in the same hot mess. Well, so thank you so much for being here. It's a delight to finally see you face to face.
Yes, you too. I loved the invite, and I love the the person we know in common, and I'm very happy to be here.
Well, I'm honored. Where are you joining us from?
I'm on the North Shore of Boston, where the sun is actually shining today, which is the first time in many days, and I feel very lucky because the rest of much of the country right now is in this frozen place, and usually we've got the worst of the weather, but it's gratefully okay today.
Well, I'm honored that you're willing to talk to us about your book and your work, because it is it's a life changer.
I remember
reading Glennon Doyle saying that this is a life-changing book. It's going to save lives. So get us going any way you want, but share.
Sure. Yeah. I guess I could talk about, you know, what my reason for writing the book. And I didn't start out as a writer. I was a big reader and lover of words, but I had a whole career in marketing and advertising and a different life, really. And it'll be 6 years, this 5 years this year that I quit my job. But what the changing event for me was really falling down the rabbit hole of alcohol addiction and climbing my way out. And everything I learned and am still learning about that process, you know, is a very classic dark night of the soul situation, except the dark night was a couple years long and replete with that, you know, story is the wisdom that you come out with. And for me, that, you know, meant seeing my addiction, my circumstances as not really being that unique, that we all have something that confronts us to the degree that, I shouldn't say everyone, but my experience is most people have something, at least one thing in their life that confronts them at the soul level, you know, all the way through, where none of the sort of coping mechanisms you've had or your skills or your experience can get you out of it. And you have to surrender to it you have the choice to surrender to it to be transformed. And that transformation is such an opportunity and such a massive gift if you allow yourself to go through it.
Well, you know, you mentioned the dark night of the soul, and there's a book, The Way of Mastery, that talks about it and says it's really the dark night of the ego and the rebirth of the soul,
yes,
or the awakening of the soul.
I love that.
And it's the willingness to face what I've been running away from that is so critical, that comes so clearly in your beautiful writing.
Yeah, the dark night of the ego. I've been doing a lot of thinking about the ego and how so much of our pain comes from that, this idea about ourselves.
And mostly it comes from, when you think about it at these deeper levels, most of our pain comes from either exalting the ego or fighting it. And, you know, it serves a role. It's there to help us navigate the world. You know, if I didn't have that kind of memory, I wouldn't remember how to get back to my house tonight when I'm done with work.
Right.
But when I think that's all I am, or if I elevate that to some high standard, or if I am horrified by what my ego tells me about who I am, either one, I'm in prison.
Yeah, that's such a good way of putting it, because I think a lot of times we just think of the former, you know, the ego sort of being inflated and running the show. But my experience was more of just being horrified about the story I had about myself, right? So much shame and so much regret and guilt and just feeling like there's something deeply wrong with you. It's an ego inflation too, right? It just manifests in, I think my experience is people seem to go one way or the other, you know, and
sometimes flip back and forth between
them. Yeah, it's the whole, I don't know if you curse on this, but it's like one of the aphorisms that I heard in the recovery program, that one of them that I use is that, you know, you feel like you're the piece of crap at the center of the universe. And that's sort of the cycle that I was in for. I mean, I think until I wasn't, you know, maybe from the beginning of childhood, I don't know.
Well, I've had a couple people I've referred the book to, and they've come back and one of the pieces that strikes them is your whole talk about learning to be honest mm-hmm. with yourself first at deeper and deeper levels, and then eventually others. And one person was telling me that just rereading and rereading the part about calling your friends after you've had lunch with them to admit, you know, I didn't really see that movie, or I didn't really, just so many people would consider just nitpicky or unnecessary. Can you talk a little bit about what that process was like for you and why it's so valuable to be honest at those deeper levels?
Yeah, this is it's the chapter that gets brought up the most often, which I find interesting. So one of the things, the main thing maybe that I had to learn as a result of getting sober and getting healing and getting more well is to be honest. And it was kind of like, it was a surprise to me, because we know when we are outright lying, deceiving someone, but there's all these other ways that we're dishonest. And I knew I had become a liar, you know, like I knew the ways that I was lying all the time. I mean, mostly to protect the drinking and the things I had done because of my drinking. I had all kinds of lies going on with all kinds of people. But then there's this layer that's more about people pleasing and not really, I look at it as like, being out of alignment, where what you're thinking and what you're saying and what you're doing are all very different things, right? So I wouldn't tell people what I would really think, because for many reasons, I wanted them to like me. I wanted to make a connection with them. I didn't want them to be angry. I wanted to avoid conflict. Like, that was my MO. And it seems like in those moments, because we call it people pleasing, and it's this very sort of socially acceptable way of being, especially for women, I find that we don't consider it dishonesty, but it creates all this friction inside of us, right? Because it showed up in my relationships. I mean, I had all these struggles in my relationships where I would just avoid conflict, little white lie here, little white lie there. Sure, I don't mind doing that. Yes, that's fine. I'll commit to plans that I know I can't do because I don't want to say no. It goes on and on and on. And you build this over years, right? Years and years and years. And then something happens and I explode. It's like the exploding doormat syndrome, you know? And it causes this big disruption in a relationship, because I had been teaching people all along, or presenting something different all along. I hadn't been honest about how I felt or what I thought. So I had to learn how to do this, though. It's not something you go, oh, because it seems obvious, like, oh yeah, of course, you know, you just start telling the truth. But for most people, it's extraordinarily difficult, because you're changing the terms of your relationships writ large, right? And that is one of the most confronting things we can possibly do. So I had to really be on to myself. And like you mentioned, silly things like having a conversation with new friends, say new sober friends, and talking about a movie and saying I saw the movie when I never saw the movie. Like, why did I say that? You know, it's because I want to make a connection with them. That's why. I want to have some common ground, right? But in the past, I would just let that go and just go, oh, whatever. And what I started to do in sobriety, because I watched these other women do it, is call myself out to say, I don't know why I did that. I don't know why I just lied. I just lied about that. That's so ridiculous. And then there's one instance where you're kind of in alignment, right? And you start to build those up and build those up and build those up. And what eventually over time happens for me is that what I'm thinking and what I'm saying and what I'm doing are much more in alignment. And there's that, for me, that means I don't have anything to hide, right?
I love the point at the end of chapter 10 where you're talking about the day that you realized it had changed and you were walking and there was just your feet on the pavement and the chewed up carrot in your mouth and the sun and there wasn't all of this racing in your head.
Yeah.
And to get there, you know, I've had experiences with different people where it's such a blessing to have a tribe or a community of people, however small, where you can agree to do that.
Yeah.
You know, there's the book, The 15 Commitments of Conscious Leadership, and they talk in there about that openness, that level of honesty. And when I was reading that chapter, even though at times I consider myself a very honest person, I found myself recoiling from that chapter, like, I wouldn't do that, not with those people.
I'm not going to take it that far.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, like, well, I don't have to talk about that stuff. And yet another part of me knows that's the only way through.
Yeah, right. And you, as, you know, as someone who deeply understands mental health and the risks of lying, the risks of secrecy and lying, even you struggle with it, right? So someone with maybe less experience and knowledge, of course, you know, we all struggle with that because I thought if people really knew who I was, they wouldn't want me around, you know, that would be the end of it. And there was also like, I had, you know, anyone who goes through addiction, and not just addiction, but that's my experience, has, you know, you have some secrets. You have some shameful stuff that you've either felt or done or both, right? And for me, I did not think that it was possible for me to tell the truth about that and still live. Like, I really didn't. I thought, I will take all of that to the grave because it's just, no one can know that stuff.
So did you have overt agreements with certain people that you were just going to start being really honest and don't worry about it if I call you after a conversation and out myself, and or did you just start doing it?
Great question. So built into the 12-step program, that which I did for a while, and it was a very good foundation. Built into that culture and is a stated radical honesty, you know, rigorous honesty, right? And so the women that I met in there, I watched them, how they were honest with each other. And I started to do that slowly on my own terms with just one or two people, right? It started there. And then with other sober people. So my experience, whether it was an overt thing, I mean, yeah, I guess it was. Because it's like you're with them, you're connecting with them for a purpose because you both want to get better, right? Whether it's a sponsor, sponsee, or just fellow traveler type of situation, you both have a common goal and you have learned or have heard that being honest is part of it. And when you're desperate enough to get better, you're willing to kind of, okay, I'll try it. Right. And it, for everyone, it's a little bit different. We all have our own, you know, one of the things that kept me drinking for a really long time was that I couldn't be honest. I just couldn't. I could not tell people the last time I drank because I had, you know, 100 times over said I was never going to do it again. And it was just too much shame and too embarrassing. But finally, the death of the ego, you know, it's like, well, I can hold on to this or I can jump off the cliff and start to tell the truth with people and see what happens. And it's, you know, it's also not this like, I think a lot of people think, oh, if I'm going to do this, I have to start telling the truth with everybody and everybody needs to know everything about me. And it's like, no, somebody eventually needs to know everything about you. But it's, you're allowed to have privacy too. I think that's an important thing to say. It was an important thing for me to hear because I wasn't going to be, you know, telling everyone everything. So I want to answer your question though, the overt thing. I mean, I also had been in therapy for years and I'd never told the truth there. I just couldn't do it. And I'm sure you experience that all the time, but it was like, I tried it out there too. You know, I practiced, it took practice. And then what I started to learn is in a few friendships, in a few new relationships with sober people, I started to build that muscle and see what happened. And what the return was for me was actual connection and intimacy that I'd never had before, right? And I had pushed away and, you know, kept everything at a distance. And
quite a shock to the system.
Totally. And not all great, you know, it's kind of confronting, but it helped. Like it helped tremendously. In the book, I talk about, you know, like one stranger who understands your experience, this, even a stranger, you know, a person sitting in a recovery meeting or even online or whatever that understands your experience can do for you what hundreds of family and friends can't. You know, we need people who understand our experience exactly. But it just takes one. It just takes one.
But to get that, I have to be honest about my experience.
Right. Yeah, that's the bad news.
and I want to reinforce what you just said about how privacy is okay, you know. And I have a lot of people that come into my office and they don't get what you mean, privacy, secrecy. You're telling me that, you know, secrets keep us sick. And I say, oh, yeah, and that's true. Because there's 10 units of mental energy that I use to hide the fact that there's candy in my drawer and I'm trying to present myself as a health coach, that 10 units of mental energy is also going to feed the conclusion in me that I'm damaged, I'm broken.
Right.
And if whoever it is finds out that there's candy in the drawer or whatever the secret is, they'll either attack me or run away from me.
Totally.
And so I feed the conclusion deep within myself that I'm damaged and broken every time I keep any kind of a secret.
Yeah.
So imagine how convoluted, how much energy I would have to spend to convince people that, unlike the rest of you humans, I don't have to eat or drink or use the bathroom. I'm not a sexual being. I'm more like a god here among, you know, the little ants.
Among mere mortals.
Imagine how much energy I would have to expend to make sure no one ever saw me actually consume a beverage or food or use the bathroom or whatever. It's crazy.
It's crazy.
But at the same time, while I am not trying to pretend that I don't have to use the bathroom or that I'm not a sexual being, I tell my patients, hopefully you will never pull up to have a session and find me out in the parking lot with my pants around my ankles doing my thing.
Yeah, hopefully.
It's private, right? There's all kinds of things.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
As long as I'm honest with myself, I don't have to be public with it to everybody else. It's the damage I do in here with my secrecy, with my conclusion that I have to hide this from somebody.
Yes.
As opposed to, I'm going to choose to share with these people and not share with those people. But I know the truth of it.
Yes.
And if I'm reading your book accurately, it's whatever I use to deny that truth, hide it from myself, and then try to hide it from others that is my thing.
It's your thing. And
that creates my problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And it requires relief of some kind. you know, because it's not, it was never about the alcohol itself. It's never about the sex or the alcohol or the
shop,
whatever, the gambling, the money, those are the things that we have to use to alleviate the pain of our dislocation from ourselves. And it's extraordinary. It's extraordinary pain. And what I say now, what I learned in sobriety was I can't stomach that dislocation. I can't deal with it anymore. If I have that, I start to get very sick very fast, and that will require relief. And I've had many learning moments in sobriety of coming up against this again and again, right?
Well, and it's the hook that the secrecy is the seed of my illness, and I keep feeding it and nurturing it without realizing it, and that the only solution to it is the profound honesty. And I have hidden and been coached by the culture and my family to believe that that honesty is going to kill me.
Absolutely.
Like you said, I'm not going to survive telling these people that.
No. No, I mean, you know, speaking for me, like I'm talking about, okay, I'm married to someone and I'm not being faithful, and I have all these very real things going on in the background that if they are found out, my life will explode, right? So it's anything from that to like hiding bottles around the house, like nobody, or taking little extra sips of, you know, vodka. That, you know, those things that seem maybe smaller, maybe not to someone who doesn't participate in that kind of behavior, but like that seems sort of like, okay, I just get to have my little secret. But then there are also big secrets. And what you said about the units of energy, like that, it only compounds. One secret begets another secret and another secret and another secret. It's just the way it works. And it grows like a virus until you're fully sick.
Right. And they feed the conclusion that you're damaged and broken.
Yeah. And I'd never heard it explained that way. And it's so perfect. Like that's the actual.
It's a mechanism.
Yeah. Right.
I can't hide something unless I'm operating and feeding the conclusion that if the person I'm hiding this from finds out about it, it's going to go badly. They're either going to attack me or run away from me. And as you said, it's that connection that, you know, allows us to grow and nurture. It's the intimacy that so many people are not familiar with and feel so awkward at first, but it's the thing that gives us the true strength.
Yeah. And that's huge, you know, especially everyone, like a lot of people have significant trauma or even just, you know, they've been taught in their families or in culture that who they are isn't okay, you know? And so it is absolutely as deep as if I do this, I will die instinct that you have to work through slowly and test again and try. But it's possible, you know, I don't have things to hide anymore. I don't, like what I say is that there's one version of me, right? It's not that I'm going to show up with you the same way I show up with my boyfriend and with my work colleagues, but there's one version inside. Before it was like completely different Laura's, you know, and what you knew about what I was up to and was totally different. It would be a complete shock to my husband, say. You know, like, I don't know what story you're getting, but it's very different than the story I have. And that's just more of what we talked about, you know, to hold up all those different versions of yourself is really painful. And exhausting.
It takes so much energy to try and keep them all straight and remember who I'm supposed to be with this group or that group, whereas...
Who have I told what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the other thing is the fear of discovery is exhausting.
Yes.
There's a tremendous amount of energy spent on fighting the fear.
Oh, God, that was my life. All the way back from being a kid, before I was drinking, there was stuff. that I was, little secrets that I started keeping for myself that I was afraid of being found out for.
Well, and as you say, I think you pointed out, I know Glenn and Doyle pointed out that the culture doesn't have us talking about all of this stuff. We have these socially acceptable addictions and cover-ups and facades.
Mm-hmm.
We move some of them from the level of acceptable up to idealized.
Oh, absolutely. Totally. Workaholism or overworking and body stuff.
Yeah, never going out without makeup, always making sure that the pictures are photoshopped and, you know, we got to have it look this way or that way. And we actually have a culture that doesn't realize, or if it does, you know, there's no big mechanism behind it. But we've stumbled into this where we're training ourselves to be fake at every different level.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and then there's the whole social media aspect, which is so heavy on my mind all the time because I have an 11-year-old who's, you know, begging to be on there. And it's just so clear to me how distorted, how much it's changed our, not just our perceptions, but like our brains, the way we process the world. So that's a rabbit hole, but it feeds that, you know, it feeds that idea that something is wrong with us, I think, constantly. Like, I would love to hear what you thought about this, think about this, but, you know, as I understand it, the purpose of healthy shame is to keep you from acting too weird that you get exiled from your tribe, in very basic terms. And most of the shame that we experience is applied, like other people's standards of what we should be and how we should act and all that. But, you know, up until 10 years ago, maybe even less, our sort of circle of concern, whose opinions we were even privy to, was still relatively small, right? But now it's opened up to essentially the world, right? I mean, I have an Instagram following where I can get 75,000 people's opinions, and it's just absolutely impossible for us to psychologically handle the judgment of and feedback of that big of a circle of concern.
And as you said, it's just so weighty. It's so overwhelming. I used to tell people for decades now, I've told people, turn off what they call the news, because it's not the news.
All the news is
the worst of the worst stuff from around the globe. It's the most sensationalized stuff. And the purpose of it is simply to keep you watching that show. And I tell people, and I've told them for decades, that if you knew everything that was going on in the town you live in, all of the horrors, all of the wonderful stuff, all of the mundane stuff, you would be filled with joy and hope. And when something unpleasant happened, you'd get in your car and drive over to the neighbor and deliver a meal or share a bedspread if their house burned down, or, you know, start one of the projects to, you know, raise the barn, put the barn up again or whatever, and you'd feel empowered. Yes. But when you hear these things from around the globe, the worst of the worst, that you don't have any control over, and unless you're somebody with, you know, billions of dollars in logistics resources, and then, you know, send them a loving thought and redirect, because there's stuff going on in your life that you do have some ability to have an impact on. And it's this, it's that thing gets amplified, as you're talking about with the social media. How can you please everybody? Even just everybody in your town, you can't. How can you please?
You can barely please the people in your home.
Exactly, exactly. How can you please, you know, 3.5 million people who follow you on this media or that? And so there's great wisdom in what you're saying, that it's an impossible task. It's the proverbial tilting at windmills to say, I'm going to please somebody.
That's the second time that has come up in my, and I never heard the tilting at windmills before until a week ago, and it is like my favorite expression now. It's so good.
Don Quixote, to dream the impossible dream.
So, yeah, no, this is very helpful to just hear, because this is really what's at the top of my mind right now and what's causing me a great amount of, an extraordinary amount of just pain and difficulty is living online a lot. And, you know, there's, it's a sobriety practice for me too. And I don't know that we, there's some people talking about that, but for me, you know, it's almost like drinking, like the idea that we could, that we should be able to moderate social media is, I don't know if it's actually possible, at least from my experience. So it's just, it's helpful to hear you talk about that as something you've been talking to people about for a long time.
Well, and the people that take me up on it come back and say, it's amazing. I don't pour all of this negative stuff in morning, noon, and night, and I have connected more with what's going on in my town and finding out about the high school students who are creating not-for-profits or delivering meals to people and, you know, helping the homeless. And the fundamental truth of it is that, yes, there are all of these negative things going on. I'm not saying that the news is making stuff up. I'm not one of those people.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I'm saying that
if
you
watch...
But
there are real problems.
Right. And there are floods and there are bombings and there are rapes and all of this. That happens. Mm-hmm. The truth is there's far more good going on in every moment by exponential, you know.
Yeah.
God,
you wouldn't feel that way, right? You wouldn't feel that way.
You wouldn't feel that way if what you're doing is watching what they call the news. But the fact of the matter is, if what was going on in the world was just what they show you, we would have annihilated ourselves centuries ago.
So true. My gosh. So true. And I think it's been exacerbated by COVID because we're sort of forced indoors, right? And or at least personally speaking, and you spend more time staring into screens, right? But the issue, I think, on the other side, or, you know, I have thought this many times, you know, go in and pay attention more to what's right in front of your face. But then it's like, well, how, you know, am I just burying my head in the sand? How am I contributing to the betterment of society if I'm doing that? And what you've said and what I have found is that you actually are only able to contribute when you focus on what's in front of you. You actually, for me, it's paralyzed me. It's stopped me because it's actually impossible to solve the problems that you're being presented with, you know, racial injustice. Like, where do you begin?
As you begin in here.
Right.
That's, you know, and so I love the wisdom from Maury Schwartz. He wrote, he was kind of co-author with Mitch Albom in the book Tuesdays with Maury.
Yeah, that was good.
At one point, Mitch asks him, Maury, how do you do it? I mean, you've never sung a note on tune in your entire life. You dance like somebody's hit you with a cattle prod. But you go out on the dance floor and you like you don't care. And Maury said, well, Mitch, if you live in a culture that doesn't leave you feeling good about yourself, you need to create your own culture. And so even with the online communities, I encourage people to be highly selective about how much time they spend with who.
Yeah.
And so if you're someone like you who has a business going and, you know, as Glennon Doyle says, you have a book that's saving lives. It's a useful tool to get your book out there and have people find out about it. But that doesn't mean you need to read every one of the 75,000 comments, right? If you do your best and put it out there and let people have their responses, and or you pay somebody a little bit to do a cursory review for you. So they're getting, you know, the wave and they can tell you, well, on whole it's positive, but some negative, or here's one thing you could correct.
So you're not trying to do it all yourself. And
I
then,
feel like this has turned into a therapy session for me.
Well, but it's just really good advice for all of us, right?
Yeah,
it is. Collective. There's that book Tribe that talks about how in community we handle so much, so much differently. But when we are isolated, we fall back into these very, very negative patterns.
Yeah.
And we don't have the intimacy and we don't have the validation and we start doubting ourselves and it gets to be a negative spiral.
Yeah. I'm just writing, reminding myself to pick up Tribes and Tuesdays with Maury again. I have it back there somewhere, but I haven't read those for a while, and they're really good reinforcers of these ideas.
Well, so, you know, if we've got 10 minutes left, we could push it to maybe, I guess 10. I have another thing I have to do.
Oh, yeah, you do.
But what is this, you know, if you do take a breath and get centered, what's something about this book or your work that we haven't even touched on yet you want to make sure to put out there for people?
Yeah, so the interesting thing for me and what is actually going to be the second book, which I'm writing right now, is the little epigraph at the beginning of the book. It's 9 things. And it came from a woman wrote me, and her sister was really struggling with addiction and she just didn't know what to do. She didn't know what to tell her. And I wrote this long response, but at the end of it was this list. And the list is 1, it's not your fault. 2, it is your responsibility. 3, it is unfair that this is your thing. 4, this is your thing. 5, this will never stop being your thing until you face it. 6, can't do it alone. 7, only you can do it. 8, you are loved. And 9, I will never stop reminding you of these things. And only some people caught on to that, noticed the epigraph. But to me, it's like that is the entire book, you know, the sort of arc of the book. And it's also the instruction that I give to myself and I would give to anybody when they're confronting their thing, whatever it is, right? Those sort of 9 things, and they work together. There's a lot of paradox in there. It's like, it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. You can't do it alone and only you can do it. And, you know, exploring those 9 things is really what I'm interested in doing now. And not specifically as it relates to addiction, although it includes that, but just as, you know, as humans that go through our stuff, you know, your thing can be someone dying. It can be a divorce. It can be having a child go through, as I am, the preteen years, which is more excruciating than I ever imagined. Just so that's the thing that I'm thinking about a lot. And specifically, 1, that it's not your fault. 'Cause that's it kind of goes back to what we've been talking about. If there's something deeply wrong about me, I should be able to get this, this better.
Right. Well, there's a list of 10 bottom line observations that I give to people in the first session. And I'll be happy to send you a copy. Yes. But one of them is, the second one is, I have seen kindergarten age children who are expert at blaming, but I've never seen blame lead to the productive or constructive resolution to a problem.
Oh.
And so I spend time in my own life and certainly in my session with my internal radar going for any indication that somebody's trying to blame themselves or blame somebody else or blame their circumstances for something in their life they don't like.
Mm-hmm.
And if that radar goes off, I call a time out and say, listen, why don't you save that for your next vacation where it doesn't matter if you waste your time? But let's get busy doing something that at least has a chance of being productive. And so, you know, the blame, the fault, it sounds paradoxical to the way we've been trained, but it isn't paradoxical to say it's not your fault and it is your responsibility. If you look at responsibility, you know, one of my favorite teachers introduced me to the concept of response-ability. It's a tool that I can pick up. And if I pick up that tool and I look at what's happened leading up to this, and I single out my part in it.
Yeah.
Not that I'm to blame or I'm at fault, but I can see what I did.
What am I able to respond with?
Now, if I own what I did that brought me here, now I have the ability to respond differently the next time a similar situation comes up. It's an actual tool. It's not a weapon to use against myself or somebody else.
That's right. The most profound, the sort of one thing I always fall back on, and I learned it from a woman who has a lot of sobriety and led me in a big way, is that I am responsible for my experience. I'm the one. So if that's true, it frames every single thing, every person, every situation I encounter differently. And it's not the best news it wasn't the best news to me, because it's you have to take that responsibility. And that's not always easy, but man, it in the end, it is the best news.
Right. It's empowering.
Right.
I tell people that you have the infinite capacity to choose the focus of your conscious awareness in each new present moment.
Yeah.
And part two, it's the focus of your conscious awareness in each new present moment that is actually creating your experience of life in that moment.
Right. It's
right there.
Yeah, it's right there.
I want to highlight something that you talked about. I mean, you just gave a kind of a toss-off comment here when you said, not that it's all about sobriety or alcoholism, but I was asking someone, very intelligent and competent, I said, hey, I'm going to be interviewing Laura. Got any questions for me? And she said, I don't really have a question, but she said, I realize I'm stymied given the question because I'm kind of awestruck. I'm starstruck by this. She said, I realize I may be still so awestruck because of hearing how similar her addiction sounds to some of the challenges I'm facing.
Mm-hmm.
It's still rather unbelievable to me. So here's a person who has not been struck with one kind of an addiction that you would single out as alcohol or gambling, or, and yet she found such deep connection and insight in your book.
That is the entire point of my book. It's one of the main points. Because for me, when I went to get sober, I had a problem with alcohol, but I was so enraged at this idea that I knew it wasn't just a Laura problem or an alcoholism problem. It was like a meta. I was not different than all of my friends who could quote unquote drink normally. We all had our stuff. And yet I was like singled out in this sort of, not sort of, this, okay, you have a problem that none of us want to talk about. Go in the corner, wherever you need to go, because that's shameful and embarrassing, and quite frankly, like, we don't want to even look at it, and figure it out with the people who also are so degraded that they have the same problem, right? There's still this huge stigma, and to me, I just knew that was complete BS. I just knew it, and it's so much of the reason people stay stuck in drinking, because to admit that you have this problem, this thing, means all these other things, because that's what we've created it to be in society, right? And the primary program for recovery, and this is not a criticism, but it's anonymous. So secrecy, be quiet, that implies this is a shameful thing. You need to not talk about it. You know, you need to go to a place where you talk about that. I get so impassioned about this because that is the entire point of my book. And I'm so grateful that she felt that way, because it's like, yeah, you're not different than me, because my problem results in me stumbling around and looking, you know, it has this icky manifestation.
Yeah. I choose to run away from my problems is different than yours.
Yeah.
But that doesn't make us different.
No, not at all. And it's so freeing to both the people who experience addiction and feel like they're, you know, specifically or especially degraded because of this happens to be their thing versus, oh, and it's also helpful for people who, like her, who go, oh, like, this is a way of talking about this and that makes sense to me. But also, we all know someone who struggles with addiction. I mean, you don't have to look far. You know, it touches most families. I don't know if you would agree. But
absolutely,
there's a lot more empathy, hopefully, that can be found and healing that can be found if you go, oh, they're not special, you know, especially broken. They're just the same as I am.
Well, I am delighted and honored that you were willing to have this conversation.
This was so wonderful.
And I really, really would like it if we could do this after your next book comes out. I love those 9 points at the beginning of We Are the Luckiest. People can find out about you at lauramcgowan.com, Laura McGowan Books.
Laura McGowan, yeah, .com. It's just my name, .com, and everything's there.
Everything's there. It's fabulous. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. And I will get back in touch as soon as I find out that you finished that next book.
Please do. Please do.
All
hopefully
right.
It's here. Okay. Bye.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, that was an awesome interview, Dr. Tim did with Laura McGowan. And we're waiting on Michael to get dialed in. And then we will continue. I see area code 602 has their hand up already, so I'm going to go ahead and turn you on, and Michael should be in by the time that you get through introducing yourself. Who do we have?
Hi, Jeannie. It's Cecilia.
Oh, hey, lady. How are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I was just reading your amazing notes on my worksheet that you helped me out with, so. I have questions
good.
About them. I just had a question. I don't know if I have to wait for Michael, but I have a question about
No. If it's something I can answer, I'd be glad to.
Yeah. Okay. So when it says that we let go of a goal to cancel the goal, I don't have the worksheet in front of me. You got to help me out with. But the part that says, and restore myself and the object of my attention to truth.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I don't know where that is in the worksheet. But anyway, go ahead, baby.
Go ahead. I'm pulling a worksheet out while you're talking. So go ahead.
Okay. So the question is, yes. I thought at first it meant that the truth that my dad is perfect, whole, and complete in reality, I mean in actuality, so am I. And then I thought, wait a minute here. Does it also mean that I'm saying,
you just disappeared. Does it also mean?
Oh, does it also mean that I'm speaking the truth about the actual things that happened? That does it have two meanings to it? So,
okay.
Do you understand?
Michael is on with us now, so she's asking about a part of the worksheet,
right?
Where it talks about choosing truth. Is that? Are you talking about the part that says, I choose to love truth and willingly face and process out the disease-producing energies?
Well, I don't know if it's on another one, but I'm pretty sure I could run and get it. The only thing, I don't want to take the time to do that. It says, in my words, that in order to cancel this false reality...
You just disappeared again, Cecilia. In order to cancel my false reality, and then you cut off.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
I cancel, let's see, and to restore myself.
And you keep cutting out. I did pull out one of the worksheets, and in step 5 it says, in order to collapse my false reality
yes.
and be liberated from my hostility fear and get back to my actual mind and the truth
yes.
about me and my object of attention.
Yes, yes.
I I canceled my goal for, and then it's
yes.
like the one we did was for your father to be respectful and honor you. So, Michael, does that statement have two meanings?
Does it mean that I'm restoring myself and my object of attention to our original condition?
Okay. So here's the idea. You have an experience that happened that involved things that were out of harmony with human life. And you've got a perceptual construct based in pain that your mind is still serving up to about that event. The object of this step in the worksheet is to restore my awareness of myself as love to my mind. And as I do that, what will happen is I'll begin to dissolve the underlying pain of that old experience that tends to create the same circumstances over and over and over again. As I do that, and I'm restored to the truth of who I am now going to restore the presence of love to the object of my attention, in this case, your dad. So I'm going to hold to the truth of who I am. Whatever dad's doing, this isn't about dad. This is about you being restored to the truth of who you are, whatever dad's doing, so that you can think, speak, or if he were still alive, confront him and still stand connected to the presence of love. It doesn't have anything to do except it is a step that creates the dissolution of the unresolved pain. Because when we have an event that happens and we take on pain and then we hide that pain from ourselves, that pain is carried forward in every instant of our lives. When I can bring it to awareness in the presence of love, that old painful energy that's carried begins to dissolve. And that's the forgiveness piece. That is forgiveness. And so I'm removing the pain that has kept me from experiencing who I am. And I can stand in the space of love with dad. Whether dad changes or not is irrelevant. It's not about
him.
So
when I change,
about you.
When I change, okay, it's not about him at all.
Right. Now, so, if he were still alive and it were time to confront him, then standing as a space of love, you might go to him and confront him and hold him accountable for his behavior. But you'll do it out of love rather than from unresolved pain, which means that you will get to heal on still deeper levels. And since he's in your genetic history, you know, what was born in your genes came from his genes, and what was born in his genes came from his predecessors. So you start to open the healing of the whole bloodline forward and backward.
So on this one.
Your voice cut out.
Video's call. Okay.
Okay.
So
you can
I'm
say that
get
again.
Rid of this phone.
Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. You're loud and clear.
In that one bio, that video for $20, that MP4 with Bruce.
Mind, body, bioenergetics.
Okay, yeah. In it, you talk about people in prison or something, and we want to punish them, and that just makes the energy strong.
Right.
So I understood all of this plus my worksheet that I don't punish my dad. I don't have punishing thoughts. I don't have shame anything that he did, perpetuating to stay alive.
Here's my offering. That
okay.
as you clean out the pain, trauma, shame in you, then you're free of that energetic influence throughout your life. Now, that might, you know, holding him accountable and, you know, Let's take a separate example. Let's say that we're downtown and shopping and somebody commits a criminal act that impacts us. Mm-hmm. And I'm in pain about, you know, that pain comes up in that. I'm going to forgive as to that criminal and that criminal act, and I'm going to be freed of that pain. And then I may walk over to the payphone and call the police and report the criminal activity and hold the criminal accountable and go to court and testify against that criminal. But I'm not doing it out of fear, rage, hurt, or pain. I'm doing it because I'm here to hold that person accountable for their behavior.
Okay.
It isn't about punishment. It isn't about vengeance. I had a mentor that was a Superior Court judge. Actually, he's the man who initiated and asked us to create Laws of Living, one of the courses, intensives that we do. And this man, he was a Superior Court judge in Albany, Georgia. He used to be the head of the whole prison system for the state of Georgia. And he sat on the bench, and he put thousands of people in prison, but he never punished one of them. And, in fact, he asked us to create Laws of Living as a way to offer healing to these folks. So he held them accountable. And what he would say is, and I hold these types of thoughts whenever I'm confronted with something as well. He would say to this person, you know, cherish you like a brother, but you're not safe in the community. And the community's taken up a collection and built a building with bars around it. And anybody who's not safe in the community, because I cherish my community, they ask me to do the job of seeing who's safe and who isn't and putting the people behind bars who need to be put behind bars. Guess where you're going? You're going behind bars. But I'm not punishing you. And by the way, if you'd like, I'll even sentence you to Laws of Living so that you can heal your mind and heal while you're in prison rather than the punishment game that we play. So if I have a punishment thought toward that criminal, that's my work. I need to do some forgiveness work. And it's probably from a time when I was punished. And as I free myself from that, it's simple accountability.
Okay. So,
does that make sense?
Yes. I have had a tendency, like I told you when I first shared this story about my dad molesting me, is that I had just put my pictures back up on my mantle that I haven't ever had their pictures on my mantle.
Right, right.
And so I was like, I just forgave them immediately. But I don't know if that was really true forgiveness if I didn't forgive.
Well, here would be my input. When you forgave the pain and trauma that you held from those experiences, then you were able to pardon him for what he did.
I don't think
then
I
you
did,
were able
actually.
To say, I would say that it was probably an automatic, you know, once you were able to relieve yourself of the pain that you held, then you didn't look at that picture and see and feel and experience that pain because you had forgiven that pain. It isn't about forgiving him. And so, you know, you could approach and look at him or look at mom or anyone else with and hold to the space of love and compassion and maybe even a blessing toward him. I mean, this Superior Court judge, he would bless every – he was a Catholic man in his 70s at the time I worked with him, and he mentored me. And he would send these – I mean, heinous crimes. I mean, this is South Georgia, heavy-duty community in South Georgia. And he would send them to prison with a blessing.
Yes.
Because he'd done his work of relieving himself of his pain.
I see.
And, you know, you'll remember that line in the worksheet that says, when I choose love, it wakes up the love in everyone. And as you can stand in that space of active love, you know, it's like you're a middle C tuning fork and you're vibrating. And the middle C tuning fork and everybody around you, the presence of love in everybody around you starts to move as well, even the person who perpetrates the kind of behavior you're talking about.
Yeah, he went to his grave. Nobody confronted him about it. I mean, nobody.
Yeah.
Not, I don't think the word confronted is the point, but, you know, nobody did any healing work around it, not even me. So
now you are.
Yeah. Now the other thing on the worksheet that Jeannie, I just read the notes, is that I bought into the I'm a slut, I'm a whore, I'm a prostitute that my mother continually badgered into me my whole childhood. And I became one. Okay? But I obviously didn't get paid, okay, so because I had no worth. Meaning I bought into it, I feel guilty when I see the word I bought into it. So you bought
thought disorders your mother fed to you?
Well, I don't know if I bought it. I didn't have any money to go out and buy it. You know, I just...
Well, when I say subconscious, I mean,
kind of ran my conscious mind, and I wasn't aware that it was something subconscious. Just going to get clear
on that.
So
what I'm saying is, as your mother, in her inability to confront father, probably knowing what's going on, but in probably terror, and, well, there's a good scapegoat, and it's you, fed you several thought disorders, that she probably held about herself that were probably fed to her as a young girl, and she just passed them on to you, and you bought it. You took on those thought disorders. So now your work is to forgive each of those thought disorders and all of the trauma that you carry around, having believed those things about yourself and having carried out behaviors that, you know, were not in your highest and best interest.
No, not at all. No one would know me that way.
Wipe the slate clean.
Yes, and doing a worksheet on every time something less than love about me comes up around that.
Perfect. That's it, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Until you've cleaned the slate of all of those thought disorders. And in doing that...
Go ahead. In doing that?
Well, remembering that you're a creator. If I choose to create something, let's say I say, I want to create this wonderful thing in my life, but in my brain's file, so to speak, on me, is I only get trauma. I'm going to source that beautiful thing, and I'm going to turn it into trauma because it's going to flow through that hidden unconscious part of my mind. Remember, that's where the power is. As I forgive and remove that, then I can create that. I'm going to create something wonderful in my life, and because there's nothing left in me, everything in me that would taint that new creation with negativity is gone. So now I get to engage in the immaculate conception. I conceive of something in the purity of, yes, I'm going to create this wonderful thing, and there's nothing left in me to taint that, and so I conceive of that, and I create that in my life. If I move in that direction and something less than that shows up, then that which is less than that becomes the impetus for my next piece of work. You know, they said to Yeshua 2,000 years ago, how do you tell where somebody's at? He says, look at their fruit. Look at the results they're producing. So you can tell what is in your unconscious by the results you're producing. So if you find yourself wanting to create something wondrous in your life and something a little less than wondrous shows up, there's the next piece of forgiveness work for you to do. And as you do, then you can literally conceive, bring forward a creative thought without taint, immaculately, and you'll produce that result. It's just what will show up in your life.
That's beautiful. I would love to have an immaculate conception of the real me. So I had a hard time, or the part of me that has a hard time with the worksheet that I did with Jeannie, that because I think there's a part of me that doesn't want to talk about it, is that did I need as a child, the end goal was in the worksheet is that I honor and respect myself and make me feel safe instead of my father.
That would be another aspect of your work around cleaning this whole issue up. Yes.
Okay, but as a child, I couldn't think that. Was it possible that I could have thought that then?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It is quite possible from being that you knew what you deserved. It's natural to each of us. It's like it comes in the package. And then, we come in as the presence of active love, and then life slaps it out of us and tells us to go find somebody to love us. And the original wisdom and intelligence becomes buried. And what you're uncovering as you do your work is your original wisdom, the blessing that you were originally and still are today. It's uncovering that and bringing that to fruition. So, yes, you may come across that worksheet and imagine yourself as a child and go back and cancel the goal to be treated lovingly, gently, and with respect and clear out another layer of the trauma that you took on.
Yes. Interestingly, my whole life I, quote-unquote, loved them. Okay, I knew what was going on, but I just loved them. "Quote unquote." Okay, so that was what you call the word would be not forgiveness, but it was pseudo forgiveness. Spiritual bypassing would be the word. That's how I understood forgiveness to be a spiritual bypassing. Okay,
right.
That meant
that's
that
what
I
it would
didn't
be.
Have to feel. Didn't have to deal with whatever was
you got
creating.
It.
Yeah, okay, thanks. I'm just trying to get clarity because this is deeper stuff than I've ever run into in my entire life. And the other thing
I got
to be clear about.
And I acknowledge you for the clarity you're getting. You're doing awesomely well at it.
Thanks. And Jeannie said, while I was having her helping me with the worksheet, she said, "Now you really spent some time here on the story. Let's walk on water, you know," which really is an awesome thing to say. And don't focus on the story so much. And I'm not trying to put words in your in her mouth, but so when I just read the notes on the session, it said, "End of my story in bold, 45 minutes." And I'm like, oh, my God, should I never talk like that again? I mean, should is a shame word. Is that unusual to talk that? I mean, will my storytelling go down? What happens?
Well, once you've, you know, each time you forgive, what happens is it's kind of like you shave off a layer of energy from the brain cells that are prompting whatever it is you're speaking, in this case your story. So as you do the work around it and there's no unusual energy left in those brain cells, your story will be there. You'll know your story. You'll remember your story was there. But there's no impetus. There's no reason to tell it. Like, why would I go there? I could go and energize all of that and set up more resonance for the same. Or I can just remember, I can remember a time, I just had. And there is a stage that people go through where it's like, I just got to get this out. I just got to tell my story. Of course, forgiveness.
Well, I shame myself when I do that. I shame myself. I go on forever, but I shame myself.
Yeah, so I'd support you letting go of that need to shame yourself because you never deserved it.
Yeah. Oh, okay,
it
thanks.
It isn't yours. It's not about you. It's just what you were taught.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that old, you've probably heard that old poem, children learn when they live, and when children learn to live with shame, then they shame themselves. When they live with condemnation, they condemn themselves, and they do that to others. And we learn to forgive those things. Then they're just, they're there. It's not that we lose the brain cells. It's just no impetus. It's like no need to. Now, it might be that you're talking to somebody, 2 weeks or 10 years from now, that's had a similar experience, and you've got the brain cells for how to heal that, and you might tell your story. I said, I can identify. I was there. Let me tell you. Here's where it went for. And you might share that, but you won't be sharing it out of this driving need. You'll be sharing it to be of service to this person so that they can hear how their story doesn't define them and that they can free themselves of it. So you'll teach out of your story in a way that helps people to let go of their story and realize
the
falsity.
I need a lot of worksheets before that, right?
Well, welcome to the club. Been doing this for 40-plus years.
Yeah.
So.
Right. No, I'm happy.
And
to.
I don't proclaim to be finished.
No, okay.
Doing a whole lot better than I did before, but I don't proclaim to be finished. It is a lifetime. I mean, literally, you're taking on all the generations of your bloodline. And when you start realizing, In just four generations, there are 31 lives.
Mm-hmm.
In 30 generations, in your bloodline and mine, there are over 1.6 billion people.
Mm-hmm.
Now think about the trauma and the drama that you've been through and that you've seen just in your close family members.
Mm-hmm.
And then take that out to recognize that ultimately what you're addressing is the repeating patterns of the trauma of 1.6 billion people.
That's a little
it's
overwhelming.
Yeah, it is. I understand. But that's what you're really doing. You know, what we're inviting people to do with this work is develop the skill and the ability to reach inside to the deepest, darkest hidden parts of their own mind energy system, bring that energy forward, develop the skill of bringing that energy forward consciously in the presence of love and letting it dissolve, being freed of it.
Yes.
And it's, you know,
it's
not something that happens overnight. It's a process, and it's a lifetime process. It's a lifetime of work.
So I think that I'm speeding it up right now, okay, by, you know, I know Lipton has a different philosophy, not forgiveness, at least I'm telling you what I understood you say, that he wants to think that it's gone in 10 minutes. And so I believe you're 100% right, and yet there's a part of me that's like, why can't I combine listening to patients at night that are like get to the alpha part of the brain? I don't know if there's actually an alpha part, but anyway. And then I listen to these things say, and your voice is getting stronger every day, and you're healing. And I liked it because it said I'm healing, because that goes with the worksheet. So right now at this point in the last couple of days, I've been combining the when I'm falling asleep listening to this stuff, and then I'm also doing the worksheets. So I want your take on that.
Go for it. You know, go for it and see how it works for you. Here's the thing. You know, Jeannie has a story, way she likes to express it, and that is, you know, we've got a garbage can over here, and it's filled with old food scraps and junk and babies' diapers and all of that. And what we want to do is be positive thinkers. And so what we're going to do is we're going to get a really nice smelling perfume, and we're going to spray over the garbage can once a day. And after a few days, you got to spray it twice a day. Another day or two, you got to spray it 3, 4, 5, 10, 20 times a day, trying to keep the stench down. Sooner or later, you got to take out the garbage. You know, the ancients said transcend. They weren't saying fly off in space somewhere. They were saying put an end to the state of trance. The idea is to get out of hypnosis. Not to enter into hypnosis so that you can successfully hide from yourself what you don't want to deal with and pretend and be able to generate perceptual constructs that pretend everything is well.
Mm-hmm.
You want to take out the garbage. And most people want to take out the garbage.
Okay. So can I get clear on this for myself? Is that that's just putting perfume on the garbage by the listening to those whatever meditations that you fall asleep to?
Suggestion. I mean, there's a section in my book where I talk about the disease of premature positive thinking in my offering. And it's just my take, you know. Others have different opinions, and so, you know, each one has
to
make
their
own choices.
No, I agree with it. It never worked for me. I had a sponsor in Adult Children of Alcoholics that used to always say, and I told her after 5 years, I'm sorry, that doesn't work.
Yeah. We shifted long time, years ago, we shifted out of doing affirmations with people or even suggesting affirmations. Affirmations can be destructive. You know, if I have an issue, you know, let's say I have an issue about money and, you know, poverty always comes to me easily. And somebody says, well, why don't you just do this affirmation? I have all the money I need. I have all the money I need. And I say that a million times. Well, I just put perfume on the garbage, but the deepest levels of my unconscious or my heart is where the power lies. So when the stress is up and the chips are down, I'm going to default back to what I haven't yet dealt with, and that is the part of my mind that holds poverty. So I call it premature positive thinking. What we do is we suggest that people take their affirmations and turn them into mind shifters. So you take the same thought, like I have a mind shifter I give people about money. And what you do is you take a piece of paper, you divide it in two, and on the left-hand side of the page you write, I have all the time, wisdom, money, and energy I need to accomplish all of my aspirations. And then on the right-hand side of the page, because that thought is a frequency, I use that as a catalyst to surface any unbelief. So what's the average person say if I say to them, you have all the time, intelligence, money, and energy you need to accomplish all your aspirations? The average person is going to say, BS, who are you trying to kid? I was always told when I was a kid that I was stupid. I'll never be smart enough to do that. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So there's your next worksheet is cleaning up the thought disorder about stupid.
Oh, I see.
So then
write
the mind shifter again. I have all the time, money, energy, wisdom, and love I need to accomplish all my aspirations. Well, what do you mean? You know, I mean, I work 18 hours a day. I work 6 days a week. I don't have enough time for anything. Okay? So there's the next piece. So you keep writing that mind shifter. Do a brain dump of all the garbage in the garbage can, and then go back and look at, you've dumped out all that unconscious information. Now go back and look at what work do I need to do to clean out that part of my garbage can and work through it rather than just layering a pretense upon pretense where you can force something to happen with hypnosis. You can force something to look good with hypnosis. But when the stress is up and the chips are down, it's going to fall apart. Because it's the deepest parts of the mind that rule how the creation works.
So that
so you want to create a space
to
access.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay. No, I did this with my neighbor who put his hands on my waist. I did a mind shifter. And I really literally took what you said is sit there for 4 hours and do it.
Yep.
So my question is to do a mind shifter, is it important to sit there and let it dump for 4 hours straight?
Well, I suggested that particularly because it was such an intense issue that was really in your face at that point. Like when we do, when we're going to do a mind shifters and still point breathing exercise, we usually give people about an hour to an hour and a half to write. But you were in a major issue, and so I suggested you dedicate a little more time than we might otherwise do.
Okay, I heard you say you give it with the breathing exercises and all that. So I did see the video. I mean, I didn't see the video. I'm wondering if it would help me to have that video or whatever they are now, that CD of mind shifters and breath point.
Still point breathing.
Whatever. Yeah.
Okay. Well, the mind shifters and still point breathing, the still point breathing part is something that I only teach in person. So that video, I give the instructions for the mind shifter, but I don't give the instructions for the still point breathing except in a live session. So there's an introduction on that video, but it's not going to explain how to do the still point breathing. And the reason for that is because it's a powerful tool and a powerful process. And we're just going to set somebody off on their own to dig into something like that and not have the support or the skills to move through it.
I see.
So I only.
But then it's important I breathe then when I do it.
Yeah, important. Notice on the worksheet how many times we've got the reminder to breathe.
Yes.
All the places where people tend to hold their breath, we want to inspire the breath to move.
Okay. Okay, I hope that there's time for somebody else. I feel like I've got some work to do.
Well, we're here to hold the space, young lady. And
all right, well, you guys are, I'll say I acknowledge myself for doing the work because I'll just say that.
Nice.
Thank you for having the work for me thank you for having the work for me to do. It's that I acknowledge I do.
Delighted to be here to support you. All right.
Thank you.
We'll look forward to the next
bye.
Time you have another layer and have questions. Okay, blessings. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
All right. Well, Ms. Jeannie, we're ready to do some reading unless there's another hand up there.
There is not a hand up.
Okay, well, let's go to Ancient Wisdom in the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For those who are following along with us, we're on page 57. And we're looking at the, we're in a conversation with this character named Richard. And we're looking at the power of the Aramaic language in describing how this human energy system works, how the mind works, and how the healing process works. So I've been talking with that about Richard, and we're on to the next thought with him, and I offer him the thought. The level of comprehension of human function reflected in Aramaic is unknown in the West, and what today is thought of as religion was simply guidance for daily living. It taught people how to best handle their family lives, relationships, sexuality, business, taxes, legal matters, land, crops, inheritance, and finances. Unfortunately, its advice has been, for the most part, ignored and thought of as antiquated by the quote-unquote modern mind. It has a thought structure so radically different from what most of us have been taught that when first confronted, it shocks the Western mind. So, and one of my favorite kind of tongue-in-cheek lines is, if Yeshua sat in most religious ceremonies and services today, he would say, that's all Greek to me. That's so foreign to me. You know, this intimidation in the name of God, this fear-mongering, this, you know, fear of God. You listen to Yeshua, and there's at least, I think, 15, if I remember correctly, 15 or 16 times he says, fear not. But we have preachers stand up there saying, fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. It's like, hello? Have you been listening to the guy that you say you're representing? I don't think so. So Greek thought has, by and large, supplanted the Eastern Aramaic thought structure that is so powerful and so profound that it's beyond anything that you see in Western thought. So what Richard responds with when I offer him that thought, he says, still sounds like a religious spiel to me. And I offer him the thought, can you let go of the conversation in your head long enough to hear that there may be more to the scriptures than your idea of religion? Investigate genuine spiritual teachings, and you will find they're about life. They deserve serious consideration. In truth, they are simply an onerous manner for your life, relationships, and body. Okay, he says, you've got my curiosity. What you said so far makes sense, so I'll listen, came Richard's wary reply. So we're starting to make some inroads. You know, we're, what, on chapter 9 or 10 here? We're starting to make some inroads into Richard's mind and his BS, his belief systems, especially about religion. And it's kind of sad that anything that even smacks of religion, and in a sense, I can understand why, because there's been, in the Greek interpretation of the teachings of Yeshua, there is so much abuse and manipulation that's happened. And so we're here to move people off of that abuse, intimidation, and it's insanity. So we're here to support people getting free of that insanity and realizing what's really there. And when you get to it, the description of how the mind works, the way to access the unconscious. There was a psychologist in one of our workshops, oh, probably a couple of years ago now, and she spouted out at one point as I'm talking about it. She's like, you know, we don't have anything that even approximates this. When the world of psychology gets up with this, it's going to be seen as genius. And it is. I mean, it really gets to the root of exactly how this human mind and this human energy system functions. And what we're here to do is to restore each and every being on the planet to the awareness of their human lives and to recognize that your human life is active present love. And all the rest of it's a lie that needs to be removed. And the removal tool in Aramaic was called forgiveness. And the Greeks turned that one backward into, well, just let them off the hook for what's happening in you. And of course, if I let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me, I haven't changed one iota of what's happening inside of me. And if I never change what's happening inside of me, I get to live the title of my book. Why is this happening to me again? And so we're here to change that dynamic. And delighted that you're here to add your ears to the conversation. We've got about 20 minutes left to open the space for conversation. If you've got a question, if you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show. And if you have a question, you push 1 on your dial pad when you've called into the number, then we'll be having a conversation. Ms. Jeannie, do we have anybody with a hand up in the phone queue or anything happening in the chat room or anything that you want to share?
Nobody has a hand up and no questions in the chat room. I'll share a little bit. I had mentioned, you know, those who were listening last week know that it was kind of a particularly challenging week with different issues. Anyway, then Michael briefed me on Saturday, and we had mentioned that that was in the plan. So going back to when you first came back up from Florida, and you briefed me, and I was given that I would expand in 5 measures. And this week, with all the challenges, I was told that my 4th measure was about being safe, and that it was safe to remember mentally and emotionally and to remember in my body, because there's been a lot of times in my life that I've kind of left my body. But the body remembers all the things that it goes through. And that I wanted to move from survival to thriving, and that it was safe to let go of coping mechanisms and to feel what was real. Breath session, I felt what was real. It was amazing. There were a few moments that I touched into thoughts that I held about myself, lies and beliefs about me personally and about my body. And there were a couple times I touched into seeing things differently about mine and my mom's relationship. But physically was the biggest eye-opener. And it started out, it's like I didn't even have words to hardly explain what was going on. But I felt like I was a total open channel. I mean, like air was just flowing completely through me, like I was breathing from my feet to my head. And I think I even mentioned to you, I felt like I was one of those loofahs that had tubes or tunnels going through it, and that the air was
right,
going completely through me. And then my body began to feel like I was a caterpillar, and I was turning into a chrysalis. And then there was like this whirlpool that pulled me out of the space and into somewhere else. And then I could see this blue web around me, sort of like in the Matrix. And I could push against the web, and it moved. It wasn't solid or anything. And my arms and my hands, they began to vibrate with energy, and my fingertips. I said that the only thing I could think of is like a little frog that has suction cups on the ends of its toes or whatever. But blue and red and yellow and white splashes of like electricity. It's kind of like those globes, the energy globes at the science fairs, where if you touch the outside of the globe, it's like all that electricity or whatever kind of zips up to your fingers where you're touching. And I felt like that's what it was doing. And I could look around. I was not solid at all. And I just felt like I was just pure energy and mostly air, and a lot of electricity and energy, and I felt like, you know, I could go anywhere, I could see anyone, and it was just like pure love flowing through me, and I really wanted to stay there. But it was an awesome experience, and realizing what real safety is, and that we are so much more than the limitations that we put on ourselves, especially physically. But it was just amazing, and thank you for your support and for taking me through that.
It was powerful. It was one of the sweetest still point sessions I've ever facilitated, and when you completed, I felt like I was in it. So the energy was moving for me as well. It was powerful. Powerful and sweet. Opening kind of on the next level to, you know, and as you were describing, you know, when you were in the session, you're describing, and repeatedly the thought, the words that Paul used, where he says, whether in the body or not, I knew not, for I saw things which I could not utter. And, you know, having had several openings like that over the decades, I can sure identify with, there aren't any words. You can't describe this. You know, the scriptures talk about the mind of man has not yet conceived what lies in store. You know, we've settled into this 9-bit mind and the perceptions that it creates, and we think that's the world that's out there, and we have no idea that that 9-bit mind and its perception is nothing but a reflection of the content of our own energy system. And as we let go, we can touch into deeper and deeper and deeper layers that go so far beyond normal perception that, you know, normal perception becomes a joke. When you put it all together, the forgiveness, the breath, the willingness, spending time, and, you know, you've been spending a lot of time more so recently just really keying into the active presence of love. And that's such an important part of the process, you know, something both of us have been doing more of. So, pretty awesome. Pretty sweet.
For sure.
And so if you're out there in listener land, go ahead, sweet.
I was just going to say, and then we had the pleasure of having this little sweet presence overnight. So she's just over here playing quietly.
We are blessed. She has brought such a profound new level of love into our space. It's been amazing. So thank you, Ari Rain. So we're down to about 12 or so minutes. If you're out there in this or land, we've got time for one or two more good conversations. What's on your mind? How can we support you? If you're on one of those shows where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. Call that number. You'll be listening to the show on your phone. And then if you push one, through the magic of technology, a hand goes up in the phone queue, and Gene will introduce you by your area code. We are deeply appreciative of having this technology available that, you know, within minutes after we complete this show, there's an archive available. You can go to our website, whyagain.org, and if you click the microphone button on the homepage, it will take you to a series of links. You'll drill down to today's date, and when this show's over, you'll have a copy of it. Or you can create a link, you know, just copy a link out of it, or you can download it to your phone or your computer and listen to it anytime you want. And I don't know, have we calculated, Jeannie, lately how many thousands of hours there are in the archives now? I don't know if we've done that, but I know it's more than 3,000. So there's so much information. So
Bob
much
asked
sweet,
in the chat room,
processor.
Why do people rant?
Why do people rant? My offering would be people rant because there's an energy locked into the brain cells that are related to the rant that want expression. And when they're triggered into activity, you know, they will tend to take over. And when they take over, what was at the root, the thought disorders at the root of it, will tend to reflect as the words we speak. And so if one applies forgiveness in the arena where there's a rant to be done, tend to remove the hostility and fear-based content around that rant, and they'll probably get more sane around whatever that is, and be able to do some healing in regard to that rather than just rant and rave and rage. So that would be my take on why people rant. There's an excess of energy in the brain cells, and that energy wants expression. And it's going to be expressed one way or the other. Now, if I decide to breathe and utilize forgiveness, I can express it via release, where it opens my physiology and I get to alleviate myself of that excessively impacted, disintegrative energy. So I get to process it out. You know, the average person rants and they say, ah, I feel better. But they haven't done anything to change the root of the energetic pattern that created the rant. So they may blow off steam, you know, for a little while, but then, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months later, they got to blow off steam again. And they have to blow off steam again. And so they end up living the title of my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? Apply forgiveness, and you take apart and remove the energetic patterns that end up being the rant that we do. Or, you know, it can go in a thousand directions. It become the abuse towards someone. It can become the abuse toward ourselves. And as you apply forgiveness, it's like each time you forgive, you shave off a little more of that energetic impetus to rant. You shave off a little more, you shave off a little more until it just dissipates and disappears. And you resolve whatever it is that's at the root of that situation. So that's where we want to go with this work, is into that state.
So I think you've answered his second question, is ranting healthy? It gives them temporary relief, but it doesn't heal.
Correct. Yeah, if the rant is in the arena of hostility or fear, then intensifying the energy of hostility or fear is going to be destructive to physiology. We suggest move over into the realm of forgiveness, and then that same energy that one dissipates by ranting and intensifies the presence of that energy, therefore the damage being done by that disintegrative energy, the same energy can just be drained off in the presence of love, removed, and one becomes freed of it, literally forgiving it, removing that energy. So I would say, is a rant healthy? Well, it can temporarily blow off steam. But is it going to produce healing? No. No, better to move in the direction of healing tools. And you've got a caller, sweetie?
We do. It's area code 541. You are on the air.
Hello, Julie here from Oregon.
Hey there, young lady. Welcome.
I'm feeling so much better. Thank you for your support, Friday.
You got it.
And I did. I got so much support. People reached out to me and informed me on things that I didn't know, but in such a consolidated manner that it was just very potently supportive with regard to the, you know, the COVID vaccine information and all,
right?
Because there's so much to sift through and sort out of. Is it true or is it not true, basically?
Right.
So
a lot of disinformation around.
Going through all of that just really opened up, you know, where I was really aiming for myself was to get back to the truth of myself, you know, remove the barriers to love's presence, remove blockage of truth, you know, and just realize, at least in this moment, two things. I called first to say how much I just stood up and breathed and felt everything Jeannie was saying about her experience. It just really reached me. So thank you and both for the breathing work that you've done together and was part of the resonance that reminded me that I really am feeling confident about the truth that I'm responsible for every bit of my reality and my experience, and so much fear now has left me from what I sounded like on Friday, which that was real then. I had to move through it. So that's
right.
The truth about me too, and that's the truth that I was asking you for too, the support and the truth. So thank you. And I'm breathing, and my friend was getting his vaccination Friday, so there was not a lot of time to discuss. So I just made determinations within myself that I will make it through this experience, whatever it is, and I will stay alert and in check with myself as to, am I letting myself slip into fear, and, you know, just correct it each step of the way as needed. So I feel pretty good about, I feel good. I do feel good about anything ahead of me with regard to all of this.
Sweet.
Yeah. So thanks. I'm looking forward to the rest of our sessions together. It's been a fantastic intensive. It's been beautiful. I love everyone in it. And just almost I have this total imprint in my brain. When I close my eyes, I have this screen full of beautiful, loving faces, you know, and I have no doubt
yes.
about any of them. They're just all resonating on the same page with me and I with them and us, and it's so sweet. Thank you so much for co-creating all this.
Delighted to be on the team, young lady, and glad that you're developing and expanding your listening ears and moving forward. It's awesome.
Mm-hmm. It is. It's really awesome. Yeah. Well, and I still have work to do, worksheets and all kinds of things, but they're good. I'm loving it. So I know that things will continue to percolate until, you know, I'm done looking at it all. And I welcome it even when I have temporary insanity myself. You know what? I've been reading the Course in Miracles principles right at the beginning of the 50 principles. And
right.
There was a year where I did one a week because I figured it was close to a year. And I had been missing a lot of the days in the workbook. So I just set up one principle a week, and it's a really great way to deepen them. And just revisiting their wording now, like everything we've been doing that's similar and related to this Course in Miracles, it's so precise.
Powerful. Powerful material.
So full of light. Yeah, truth. My throat's getting a little congested. But anyway, yes, I'm going to be moving on, I guess, and see if you might have another caller, but it's great to, I love Aria Rain also. I love her presence. I feel like kin with her. So
we are so blessed, let me tell you.
Mm-hmm. And I just think she really turned that 999 upside down. You know, or she turned the number 666 upside down and made it all beautiful and exciting. Because what a weird phone number I used to think. Gosh, who wants a number that starts with 999? But it was perfect for Aria to memorize one of her first utterances in life, you know?
Yep.
Sorry.
That's pretty cool. Doesn't get better than the presence of a little one like that. This morning, Jeannie was just, I was coming upstairs and Jeannie just finished changing her diaper, and she gets up and runs over and says, hold, and get a big hug. It's like, you know, it doesn't get better than that.
So she must mean, please,
all right, young
hold
lady.
Me, I'm a space of love. Hold me, I'm a space of love.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right, lots of
okay.
love and blessings. Take care.
Blessings.
Right. Thanks, everybody, for being us. With us, have the best year yet if you return to life. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet, as we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We are here for 2 hours every Monday through Friday from 12 noon to 2 o'clock Eastern Time. on Mind Shifters Radio. For more information on Aramaic forgiveness, please visit www.whyagain.org. That's www.whyagain.org.